well, let's just have a really video gamey map, and then like people can pull up the UI, and then there's a dot telling you where to go. Like, the temptation to do that is so strong.
This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. He's now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Jane Ng. Jane is a longtime game and environment artist, now working at Campo Santo on their highly anticipated game Firewatch. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Very excited for this episode. I actually just happened to get to see Firewatch in real life just at XOXO a couple days ago.
Oh, so awesome.
It's very fresh for me. But the origin sort of for our topic today, which is 3D art in indie games. Obviously, mm-hmm. Jane is an artist. It's a perfect fit topic-wise. But Jane, you gave a talk at the GDC conference about the art in Firewatch that you've been developing.
Yeah.
Do you want to kind of start with like a little overview of what that was like and what you're talking about there?
Sure. So in March of 2015, I gave a 25-minute talk at GDC just about sort of, I guess the art of Firewatch is the topic, but really is sort of just a brief talk about how we're translating sort of a pretty sort of graphic poster art look into a 3D environment that a pretty small team can make in 3D. Let's see, what did I talk about there? It's been a few months after you've been...
Yeah, well, no, I think that's like a really good summary. And
because
I mean, the way you described it during the talk was like, well, we're just going to talk about art in Firewatch. But in practice, the thing that flows through all of that, for anyone who hasn't seen any of the videos or, mm-hmm. or gameplay or anything that have been released from Firewatch yet, it is this very stylized look. And so there's, I mean, two really mm-hmm. obvious challenges just to me, even just as a like an observer. There's this very stylized look that was done by Ollie Moss, which is mm-hmm. this great 2D artist that does all these posters and stuff like that, and does this concept art. This like, okay, here's this beautiful thing, but then you're trying to like do that in the 3D game engine that isn't necessarily intended to do that. Often it's more built in mind to say, okay, well, how do you make something look kind of like a life? And this like sort of gradientized concept art doesn't necessarily look like life, which I thought was an interesting.
Yeah. It's one of those things that's hard because when you look at a picture of it, you're like, oh yeah, it feels amazing as a 2D picture. But then since our goal from the beginning has always been a first person 3D game. So my main challenge is to like, how do I actually bring the same feeling that is evoked in a 2D image, and how do I bring it into a world that you can actually walk through? Because if you look at that image, which you can see at firewatchgame.com, it's sort of like a lot of layers of colors. And if you're making a sort of 2D flash game essay, it's pretty straightforward how you would translate it into a 2D game. But for 3D with... not only do you walk through the game space, we also have a lot of different time of day changes. So it has to be a very different solution than just, you know, painting all the colors all in different assets. So it was a good challenge, but I always like a good challenge. So that was an easy thing for me to sign up to do.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's like a common thing or if it's particularly... I'm not sure if you saw the concept art pipeline very often, Nigel, when you were in this sort of more AAA games industry or not. But I can see in this particular case it being this. I mean, in general, in indie games, you're often going for a more stylized look. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure to what degree that is like a unique thing for this game, but it's definitely as soon as you see the concept arc, it starts to look more like not quite a cartoon, but it has that sort of, I guess, a Pixar sort of esque feel to it with the stylization. Have you found that the stylization has been helpful or creating more work as far as trying to like get out a nice, a great looking, honestly, if you see the screenshots, a great looking 3D game on such a small team?
I think If you sort of know what you're going for, it can be easy in certain aspects, but it's also actually quite hard to do stylized art. So I wouldn't go as far to say that, yeah, going stylized is definitely easier, because it just sort of poses very different challenges. It's funny because we were just, actually me and Jake today, we're just sort of talking about how we, you know, while we have that key art from very beginning, it is a hard style to stick to. We've definitely noticed certain style drift throughout production, but you know, that's the part about doing stylized that's really hard, is that, for example, the key art doesn't have any sort of like dirty assets in it. And so if we we have a prop artist that help us do this stuff, so he works remotely with us, and he's great. But the thing is, with something like a stylized piece of art, if you don't specifically concept everything, then it is hard to just be like, hey, just make a dirtier piece of, let's say like a grimy piece of, I don't know, like let's just, this book, make a dirtier version of this book. But then like, what exactly do you mean in the style would this be, you know? So like, you have to define everything if you're going stylized. And sometimes it's easier if you're going for more realistic look sometimes, because hey, everybody can look up a, you know, a photo of something grimy, and then, you know, that would just be the dirtier version or whatever. But with a stylized game, that is the stuff that is hard, because everything has to be super defined. And if you don't define it, then you can end up with style drift pretty easily.
That's definitely something I saw a lot in the couple of games that I worked on that had like a stylized look. It is the thing you were talking about, of the issue of it, the concept art becomes a lot more important. Yeah, like for more realistic games, a lot of the concept art is like, hey, this is the kind of stuff we want in the game, or here's the ways that it deviates from reality. If there's going to be, you know, way more, you know, lights with lens flares on them or something like that than you'd see in reality. But the other thing that I always found with the more stylized games, I'd be curious to know if this is the case with what you guys as well, is that it also makes it harder for like the art and the tech staff to work independently, because a lot of times the achieving the look is dependent on tech to a much greater degree than it is with realistic art. Yeah. With realistic art, the artist a lot of time can just kind of sit down in Maya and like paint out their textures and, you know, follow the style well and see what it's going to look like. Whereas oftentimes when you're dealing with something more stylized, what it's going to look like in the game and what it looks like in the art production tool don't match well.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we were really lucky that we worked with a graphics programmer / tool programmer that really believed in sort of just making a tool that enables the artist to do whatever the artist want to show up on screen. So a lot of our tools, I talked about the procedural art tool in the art talk. We don't, you know, there are all these different procedural sky tools that, you know, try to like simulate, you know, whatever atmospheric blah, blah, blah. Like we don't go for that at all. We were basically just like, can you just let me pick three colors? And that's how we define a sky color. And so we made the tool with that in mind. So, you know, like that helped in the sense that like the tool really sort of served what the artist workflow would be. So that helps.
The whole business of skyboxes I thought was really interesting in your talk, because until I knew Nigel and like started talking and digging more into how games are made, something that's really obvious had never occurred to me, which is that in most games, the sky is just a giant cube with a sky painted on it.
Yeah.
and that's, and of course, like you fall back into that illusion when you play any well-designed game. But like the fact that it's just a cube, and that like if you were to take the textures off or, you know, make them flat, that you would actually see the like flat shading is kind of hilarious. And so you were talking, and I was also reading, was Paolo the name of the?
Yes.
Yeah, Paolo the graphic developer that was working on this procedural sky generation tool for you, was like exactly like you said, was that okay? Yeah, typically you build this skybox and you paste on some texture and you say, okay, well, I'm going to make some, the artists are going to paint or design these really beautiful clouds and the sunset or whatever, and that's great. But then what happens if you walk and you want to have a trigger volume when they like, okay, they walk into this area and then clouds come in and they start to it starts to rain or some mm-hmm. you know, something changes about the sky, all you can really do is sort of like crossfade in between those two things. Yeah. Like you can't just make a thing and a totally different thing. And like the sun is moving across the sky, of course you can like add the sun as an object, but going to a completely math-based like, okay, mm-hmm. this is the sun and this is the way that the sun does what it does against the horizon, stuff like that, not based on trying to simulate pixel or simulate actual physics, but just simulating this is the look that we want. I thought it was like pretty brilliant, and like the results are obviously amazing. Like if you just look at the screenshots on the Firewatch site, it's pretty obvious that the sun is one of the kind of heroes of the game and the sky, right?
Yeah. The funny thing is, I think Unity 5 now has a similar tool. But so anyone using Unity can actually try to make a procedural sky. And the reason why we decided that we really want a really much more sort of artist-driven way of working with it is like that tool shows sort of how like if you really try to be like physically based, like it really like it's really hard to just say using that tool just going like, you know what, I just want the top of the sky to be red and the you know the horizon to be orange. Like it is really hard to even just get that because you're controlling three other sliders that has nothing to do with color to just try to get the, I don't know, atmospheric something, some fancy technical name.
Yeah, that what's is the not Rayleigh just context of this coefficient? And you're like, I want it to be purple on
I
the
know,
top.
I just want it to be orange. Like, I don't know what these other numbers mean. So like we, you know, I feel like a lot of, sometimes I feel like there's a disconnect between, like you're saying, like, you know, more like maybe AAA realistic looking tools are really sort of physically based these days and is really based on like real numbers, blah, 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 blah. But if you're going for like a stylized look, you really kind of have to think about your tools in a different way like this. Like who cares what the actual physically based whatever is? I mean, you're doing a stylized game. It is, you know, those numbers don't matter. You just want red.
To be fair to the people who are developing the technology, they kind of don't have a choice, right? Like you... The nice thing about the physically based modeling is there are a lot of games going for realistic style. There's well understood parameters there so they can mm-hmm. make that tool and have it be something that's generally applicable. If you're going for a very custom art style,
yeah,
you know, the tools aren't going to be aimed at that. They can't be because so much of what you need is dependent on what style of art you've chosen, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I guess that sort of goes back to the whole question about like, well, is stylized easier than realistic? It's like it really sort of depends on what your tools are built for, you know. And because physically based thing is really great to make content for, but if you're, you know, let's say like trying to make a sky in a very specific way, it may be a lot harder.
Yeah, everything that I'm seeing in as someone who is not spending my time making 3D games but is deeply fascinated with them, when I'm looking at the release notes of things like Unreal, they're all talking about like physically based rendering and stuff like that. But Unity, which is also having extremely fast paced development, I imagine might be a little more, maybe it's not more adaptable, but you know, probably easier to turn the knobs and dials to make it do things that are not necessarily based on reality, if that's the way that that you're going for in the game.
I think Unity, the good thing about Unity that we really like is that it really sort of allows for you to build on top of it. I mean, if you've seen the Unity Asset Store and how much of the power of Unity is actually based on the extensions that you could buy, so I think you can customize Unity to sort of fit your style of game depending on just which extensions you choose to add onto Unity. And I think like that really helped us a lot because we just sort of picked and choose what we wanted to add to it. And when you buy an extension in Unity, it comes with a code, and a lot of people expect you to then add your own thing on top of it, you know. So it worked out great for us in that way in terms of using with Unity.
Yeah, I saw you'd mentioned a few of the plugins, and like that's something that is a huge boon, obviously, to a small team.
Yeah.
That you obviously can sometimes say, "Build me this tool." The sky is super important to our game, and so make this tool for doing skies, then that's cool. But if you're like, okay, and also we need something to do this and something to do this and something to do this, there are things that are in every game, like these Unity tools that you mentioned, like one of them was color grading, which is obviously for a stylized game, but really any game, like, or, you know, film, they do all the time, right? And it's like $100 tool, like, and it's like, well, like,
there's actually, I think, Amplify Color, which is the extension we use for color correction, I think is actually $40 a seat or something. It's like, it's incredibly cheap. We bought it thinking that we would just, oh, you know, if this is the, it was like on a Unity sale, so we bought it for $25 a seat or something. And so we're like, we just buy one and just see like how we like using the tool, and we can then make our own better. You know, like, we just, like, you, it's like $25 even for a lesson of, you know, whether this is the thing you want. It's, is so cheap. And then we were like, hey, this does exactly what we want and then some. So you're then like, you just hit jackpot like that sometimes. And I feel like that's happened with me with Unity multiple times. Another thing that I really like to list as an example is that, you know, we didn't have any sort of birds in the game. And I was just like, oh, you know what? I'm willing to spend $10 to find just like a good bird, you know? Then James, our animator, can rig up and, you know, then we'll have like a bird or whatever. That'll be kind of cool. $10 is cheap, right? You know? And then I looked at Unity store, and then for $10, there was a whole bird scripting package that has flocking behavior, and you can script the path of the flock, and they even like do collision detection and stuff, all for $10. I just couldn't believe it.
That's so amazing.
And so like, we're like, well, of course we'll buy this. And you know, so you just get jumps like that.
And now there's a bird in the game.
Yeah, no, we have a whole flock of birds actually.
Yeah, which you wouldn't have had a flock of birds otherwise. You might have had, okay, well, at least we have a bird and we can, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
maybe he sits on a thing and when you get near it, he flies away or something. But now you have a flock.
Yeah, now I have a flock that I can actually just be like, oh, this is exactly how far I want them to flock. And, you know, this is how much I want them to dive and how much I want them. You know, it's crazy. I just couldn't believe. There are just lots of little things like that on the Unity store.
And that's one of those things that just wouldn't be worth building on a small team normally, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, big game teams do stuff like that all the time of just like, all right, this guy is just going to go off for a month or two and like implement this.
Yeah, and build like a wildlife system.
This minor system that's layered on top of things. And, you know, if it was missing, you wouldn't even notice.
Exactly. But
just to increase the polish and, you know, small game teams. I think that's one of the things that makes 3D games from small game teams challenging is that you tend to get these very barren worlds, you know, like the sort of canonical indie 3D games are always these quote unquote walking simulator style right. games, right? Where it's like this very static world that you're traveling through, that there's not a lot of stuff going. And, you know, part of that is you've got those restrictions of like, you just don't have time to build all those systems. If you can pay $10 and have, you know, have the system and just be able to start scripting right away rather than having to have a developer spend a few weeks or a month building it first, that's a huge leg up.
Yeah, totally. Or even just stuff like really essential things like Playmaker is the thing that I think a lot of people use, and it's just a visual sort of scripting system. Like, I don't even know how we would make the game without that, you know, but like all that kind of stuff. I guess Unreal has an Unreal store, but I don't actually know how robust this stuff is.
I get the sense the Unreal store was like, they saw that Unity was eating their lunch with this
yeah.
stuff. Because you think of the stereotypical AAA game developers like, you know, oh, we're going to create it ourselves. But then you see like Blizzard uses Unity instead of Unreal for Hearthstone. And then you're like, uh-oh. Like,
yeah.
And so they have this Unreal store, and I'm sure that there's some good stuff in there, and it might be like higher caliber stuff that you need. But if you look for a bird on the Unreal store and then you see like a, you know, $400 a seat thing that can create entirely new species of bird that's yeah. written in C++ and is really performant or something, then that's not necessarily going to sway you compared to this little thing that someone hacked together in C# that's actually a pretty great little thing for making flocking and
yeah.
birds in the game and the scale.
And I think the good thing too about the stuff like the Unity store for a small game team is that like when we're making tools, now we're thinking about how like, you know what, we should probably make it like a thing we could then eventually package out and also sell in the Unity store, because why not? Like, that is definitely something we think about when we make our own tools. Because it's just like, well, you can get extra cash and you can also just help other teams. Like, you know, for example, our procedural sky tool. I would really love it when we're done with the game that we would just make it a thing that other people can use and, you know, just charge a few bucks and it's great for everybody, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that entire process, I mean, similar to what open source and community code and sharing has done in other fields of developing software, it just accelerates the entire industry in that people are able to make stuff. And it's especially important in games, which is sort of why it's sort of funny that it seems to have happened slower in games than it has maybe in other, like on the web development, like no one writes anything. You just type like one character and import 500 node packages and you have a website. It's like a slight exaggeration, but in games, it's more recent that this phenomenon is coming up, but it's more important in games because the purpose of the game is not to create a thing that simulates bird flocking. Like the player doesn't care about that.
Yeah.
One of the other sort of tools that I thought was super interesting that you're talking about and is like, I think, pretty key to the feel of the game from what I've seen is this fog system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What we call stylistic fog. It's a very technical name.
Yeah, but I mean, it's something that like I wouldn't even have thought of, but it's actually a really elegant solution. You have this sort of look where you want layers of trees that go off in the distance. And like, even though it's not something that's really physically based in the way that if you look at all these art, it's like, okay, yeah, there's this layer that's like getting more and more brightly colored as the layers of trees go back. And that's not quite the way that the world is. But if you look, like Nigel and I are in Vancouver and our mountains, often you see these layers where, okay, there's this mountain is bright green and then there's one behind it has a different color and one behind it. And because there's a fair distance in between the mountains, but you can see layers of them, each mountain kind of looks like it's all the same color. And then it almost looks like cutouts of cardboard or paper.
Yeah.
What do kids use the paper? You know what I'm talking about? The cardboard that you would use colored.
Construction paper?
Construction paper.
Yeah.
That it looks like that. Anyway, so this, do you want to talk a little bit about that sort of fog system you were able to use to get that, that sort of effect in a game?
It's funny because, as I mentioned before, that a lot of these things were really, you know, like, we weren't kidding when we were saying, like, we looked at the key art and then we're all like, okay, we have to make a game that tries to be as much like this as possible. But, you know, even in the beginning, I was like, yeah, we can try. Like, I really, like, right now, I'm actually, whatever we have in the game right now really sort of exceeds what I really thought we could reach. But part of the reason is stuff like, well, when I look at that key art with the layers of colors, like, I immediately thought that, well, we have to use fog. But even then, when I told Sean and Jake, that was the first thing out of my mouth. They were like, you would use what? You would use fog? Like, that doesn't seem to make sense to them.
Well, especially because fog has this bad name among gamers as the thing that people would do when the game was not optimized well enough to draw stuff that you just put fog everywhere.
Like, you're like hiding stuff or something, right?
Yeah, you're like, oh, it can only show up to like 100 feet in front of you. So everything, suddenly this location that doesn't seem like it would be foggy, but suddenly you have a very foggy desert. And
fog also has this really interesting property of like fog in real life actually doesn't look as interesting as you want the effects to look into the game. Like, if you're in a fog bank, it literally is just like, you know, things get hazier and hazier, and by like a few hundred feet away, it's just white. Whereas usually that's not the look you want in a game. What you want is something more like ground haze and other atmospheric effects that are not really fog. They're sort of,
like, you wouldn't call that fog in real life, like what we actually
yeah, they're things you wouldn't call fog in real life. But in fact, that fog, like the, you know, just white fog, that's really easy to do, as it turns out. That's why for so long that was a, you know, that was a very normal standard kind of things in game, is having the just like, oh, you know, we'll just fog things out in the distance and whatever, because that's actually quite easy to model. Whereas areas of different atmospherics that are sort of overlapping and there's different distances between you and the things is quite a bit harder to model.
I guess like I sort of like immediately thought of using like a generic fog system to try to get that effect, because when I was at Double Fine, I did a lot of the world lighting as well. And that lighting system, had like a dynamic sun when we were working on Brutal Legend. So it was all sort of dynamic time of day. And I had a lot of experience lighting with a directional light and a skylight. And then basically fog is all you get other than post process effects. And so I knew from working with that system that if you use fog correctly, you actually could simulate a lot of what, like in your head, you don't consider in real life as fog, but like really just atmospheric haze. Like if you do it tastefully, like it could really bring a lot, like it really sort of gels all lighting together if you do it well. So when I saw that key art, I was like, well, we could use fog if we can then actually define different colors for different like depth away from the camera, which was the thing I proposed to Paolo. And then he just basically implemented it in a day. And then that's actually that ended up being the system we have. So that was actually the most sort of simple tool that we, you know, it was like the most like, let's try this. And it totally just worked. So I guess that we got lucky in that way. But obviously we also decided to really push it once we saw how powerful it actually was. So.
Yeah, I saw that you'd actually put together, or Paolo put together a tool where concept art could go and make a channel, or like a gradient strip, yeah, the way that you would define in Photoshop, and say, okay, I want it to be like bright green, but then like when you get to a certain distance, yeah, then it gets bluey and then gets dark really in the distance, right?
Yes.
You can imagine that creating like the fact that really there's a dark drop off gives a sense of like, oh, it's over there. Maybe it's kind of, you know, like you can evoke all these different emotions and just like, you know, obviously in the visual style of the game, it's something that the amount of time it might take for Ollie to make a little gradient thing in Photoshop can have a huge emotional payoff compared to going and say like, all right, so what I need to do is to paint all these,
exactly,
trees and objects a slightly different, yeah, color.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about color grading earlier. That's essentially sort of the magic of color grading. If it's done well, I think the kind of fog that you're talking about is in some sense another form of color grading, right? It's like distance-based color grading. And you know, the magic of it is that it gives you a way for like people to approach the overall look and feel of the scene without having to change every individual piece of art in the scene, right? That you build all of your art in a very plain, flat looking kind of way, like something that kind of looks like, you know, like Quake 1 era, like dawn of 3D technology, when it's just in the art stage, and you say, well, how is this going to look any good? But how it looks good is then you take, at least this is how we did it at Radical, and I think other people use similar techniques, is you'd take like a screenshot of the boring art and then give it to an artist, and they basically like muck around with it in Photoshop until they got it looking a way that they thought was good. And then there was a tool to like take the good looking art and turn it into a color grading chart. Right. And you can also just build those by hand. Like, you know, in the case of the fog, it sounds like that's what you're doing, is just like make a little strip, but it gives you that like really nice artistic control over those things that if you, you know, if you want to try and build the art like that, you certainly could. Yeah,
but then you're locked to it, you know, then you can't change.
Yeah, it'd take you way more time to do it, and you can't change it, right, as quickly as you can if you're leaning on things like color grading tables and your fog table and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the cool thing about our tools now is that basically everything hot reloads. So I guess I can describe for people who are listening about actually what the stylistic fog tool actually is. So basically you have just a strip, like a very tiny strip of color that is 128 pixels wide. And you define for the tool what distance from the player that the first pixel on the left actually is. And then, you know, and then like imagine how like if you are pixel number one, like where you are, and then the strip is just like, you know, the distance away from you, like along where the camera goes. So if you're saying, okay, can you just like put this color of this, apply the color of the texture strip from me to 100 meters away, and then it will just like sort of affect the scene like what you painted in that color strip. So that's kind of how it works. And so we have like the whole starting distance, ending distance, and a strip of texture, and that's like the three inputs. And so if you're an artist, you can change the color strip on the fly in Photoshop. Just hit save, and then you can instantly sort of see the changing result in the game. So that makes editing super easy.
Yeah, and like Nigel was saying, that approach of doing it, just like, okay, this is the color we want in this circumstance and this thing, along with your lighting and stuff like that, probably makes it, I imagine, a lot easier to reuse the same area in different moods and different times of day and different, like, okay, yeah, this was the happy, easy area where you figured out the controls, but now it's the dramatic area where, like, you know, something bad has probably happened and you're rushing to get back to your tower or something, you know?
Yeah, totally. Because the original design of the game, there wasn't a lot of time changes, but once we realized that, oh, hey, you know, we basically have a way to do dynamic time of day and do it well and actually just like really change the mood of even what, let's say, like a morning, like, a you know, mornings can feel very different if it's a sunny morning, a foggy morning, or like a creepy morning. Like, we could do all that and we can just like switch it out super easily. We're just like, well, let's just do it everywhere. Because it was actually that easy to author different lighting content.
That's the thing about these kinds of looks these ways. It sort of separates the thematic elements of lighting and the like practical, you know, you need to be able to see stuff and you want to have shadows cast element of lighting, right? Like, you know, looking back to like 10 or even 15 years ago when you were doing 3D art, you had to do a lot of that mood stuff with lighting. And like, not only did you not have much in terms of lighting, but you had to say like, all right, if we want this scene to be like a particular color, you know, either we just bake that color into the textures or we have to come up with a lighting environment that sort of adds that color in. Whereas now you can, you know, it's not going to be perfect. You know, it's still better. Like, hey, if you can afford to do a custom lighting rig for every time of day, great, go for it. But if you can't, you can just say, right, all right, well, we'll light it for visibility and then we'll add the mood with a color grade effect. And that, I mean, essentially, like, real film production does that as well, right? When you're shooting day for night, when you're doing film, it's the same thing. If you're saying, we're going to shoot in the daylight, and we're just going to say, like, yep, the light of the sun is for illumination, and then we're going to do color grading tricks to turn it into night. And, you know, once you know that people do that, and you know sort of what to look for, you can see it in films, but it's pretty good for what it sounds like in terms of how good a look it gets, right?
Well, we did that ridiculous thing where we were recording, we were recording like a commercial, just a video we were doing for an app that Nigel and I had built. And we wanted, it was a party DJ app, and so we wanted to show, like, oh, I'm at a party at nighttime, and my friends are going to get in here, I'm setting up the music. And so we got in there, it's like 9 a.m., and then I get into the place where we're recording it, and I'm like, oh my god, the light is horrible, this is not going to remotely look at nighttime. And the lighting guy's like, it's fine, it will look night. And I'm like, no, it's not going to look at night. It's not. And he just lugs in this giant LED array, flicks it on, and I'm like, oh my god, it's night. Just the color of washing everything, and just suddenly, like, yep, it just, my brain now has decided it's nighttime because that's the color that it is at nighttime. And yeah, it's amazing how our brain kind of does that. Something that I thought was quite interesting about light design in general in games is that you often want to use light to highlight things, and games often do that, especially games that are have like specific objectives that you need to go around and notice things, which you do in Firewatch from what has been kind of shown and what I saw at XOXO, that you know, there's little objects on the ground, you want to notice them, you want to interact with them. And the typical way to do that is like, hey, this thing that you want to notice, like these footprints or something, just happen to be under a streetlight, or they just happen to be under, like in Destiny, it's like, oh, there's a lot of rocks that just glow a lot in this alien world, because that's, which the alien world being like Mars, but for some reason, suddenly Mars has a lot of glowing rocks to like highlight things. How have you worked around that in Firewatch? Has that been kind of tricky?
Yeah. Because
there's not really any, it's set in the wilderness, pretty much in the middle of nowhere. So the artificial lights are pretty much just constrained to your little like home base in the tower there. Does that come up, or are you just kind of?
Oh yeah, it comes up a lot. The funny thing is like you said, since we're making a realistic game, meaning like it actually is supposed to be happening in 1989 in Wyoming, in like our world. So like, you know, like it is a national forest, and we build it like a national forest, not like, oh, you know, there's a whatever here. Like, we try to actually make it seem like it is from the real Wyoming, which makes things like, you know, it does make a lot of solving video gamey problems really hard, because actually that, I would feel like that's probably the toughest part of doing art for this game, is to just, you know, explain stuff like why can you not go over there? Because we don't have force fields. We don't have, you know, you can't even really have a fence everywhere.
There's no guards to say, you can't go over here.
Exactly. So like, that actually is one of the toughest problems. And like you said, like, how do you point people going the right direction, or just like, look at the one beer can in this giant metal? Like, that actually is a big problem. And we've been trying to solve it by a lot of just like, I don't know, just like placing things. Like, when I build the environment, I do sort of build it like almost like a stage, as in there are a lot of things you could do subtly with the way you're placing your trees and the rocks to just guide the player's view to certain areas, like even if you don't do anything with lighting. So I really try to pay attention to that. But then on top of it, you know, yeah, there are a lot of things just like I'm trying to explain without having to
reveal anything you're not supposed to reveal.
I know. But let's say, like, I think this is part of the game where you have to find a couple of teens in the lake. And we did definitely decide that, like, we're going to design it so that you're walking towards the sun the whole time, because people naturally walk towards the light, kind of thing. So like, we do think about stuff like that, you know, but it does get tough.
I guess you do have this business where, like, the two really basic things you have from what I saw, and that was the part of the game. I'm not sure if that's really, really the beginning of the game, but that's the part that I saw it.
It's pretty close to the beginning.
Yeah, you walk out to find these teens that are causing a problem towards the sun, which you just sort of naturally do because it kind of seems right. And then when you can turn around, you're like, okay, well, I want to go back to the tower, and like, the tower is high, so you can see the tower. And like, so going in between the sun and the tower is your like kind of axis of movement that's pretty easy. But I would imagine like getting someone to go sideways,
yeah,
which unless the entire world is just like one tunnel, which I mean, most games, honestly, even like something like Destiny with a $500 million budget, once you actually plot out the levels, they're all tunnels.
Yeah. That's the thing, like, it's funny because I try to describe our level design as more like, instead of tunnels, because tunnels are boring, right? Like,
if you notice, even though tunnels.
Yeah, exactly. But like, functionally, yes, they're tunnels, but I kind of prefer to think of it as like a ski trail. Like,
oh, for example, that makes sense. Makes it more fun.
You know, it's like, you know where you get on the lift when you're on a ski slope. Like, you're getting off the lift and you eventually get back to the lift, but whichever way you go down the slope is up to you. Like, that's sort of my approach, is to give people the freedom to do, or at least the illusion of freedom, I guess. Like, you can go wherever you want, but if you want to keep going, you're gonna have to get back to the lift, you know. And as long as you're really clear to people like how you get back to the lift, and I think you can give people a lot of ways to explore and make the game feel bigger than it is without them feeling lost. But it is definitely a tricky thing to do in something like Firewatch, when we're trying to not put a lot of signage, we're trying to not put a lot of man-made stuff in it.
Well, you don't want to make all the objects that you're supposed to notice glow.
Yeah, exactly.
But a lot of games do that at the last minute after playtesting them. It's like, people are not finding these things.
Yeah. And I think we do give player a compass and a map. And we were really worried that that may not be enough, because the temptation to just be like, well, let's just have a really video gamey map, and then like, people can pull up the UI, and then there's a dot telling you where to go. Like, the temptation to do that is so strong, because you freak out whenever people don't know where to go when you're making a game, because, you know, people not knowing what to do, it just sucks. Like, it doesn't matter what game it is, right? Like, if you don't know what you're doing. But we were like, well, how about we just actually try to make people learn the world if you give them a compass and the world actually fits to the map, and then you And we do, you know, since in the game you do talk to Delilah over the radio a lot, and we try to add a lot of sort of support dialogue with that if you're lost. It seems like people actually are not very much lost while using the in-game map, but it will be interesting.
Having the tower, I think, is that's sort of a nice, like, synergy there between concept and design. Is like, it's something that totally makes sense given the game world, and it's also something that serves really nicely as an anchor point, right? That any time you can see the tower, you've got your bearings, and you've always got that aspect of like, okay, well, if I'm going back from something, I can always just head back towards the tower. And I don't know if that, how intentional that was, like whether you guys sort of thought about that in advance, but it seems like something that works out pretty good.
Yeah. And you can also always see another tower. So that's another thing that's always sort of in the vista. So you have your own tower, but you can always see, not always, unless you're in the middle of a valley or something, but like Delilah's tower is also really clear, and that's always to the north. So we will see if people get lost. Yeah. I think we're hoping that people will get, like, we're, you know, trying to like sort of like train the player to actually be able to look at the world and know where they're going, because we're trying to construct a world in the sense that if you actually try to understand it, it is pretty clear, but we'll see. You know,
another
really
common thing that people do is that they start putting in more obvious landmarks, right? Like if there's an area where people start not realizing that they're in that area, then it's even just something as simple as like, okay, well, for whatever, we're going to color grade this a little differently so that it's really dark here, or it's really bright here, or that someone discarded some object 50 years ago. Now there's an old rusted Chevy here for some reason. Why? No, it seems like there might be narrative. No, it's because people didn't realize that this
just
is the
need
same
to
crossroads.
Landmarks.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Now, one other element of like the, you know, the sort of world of the game and the build out process and balancing the size of the team that I'm kind of curious about is characters. Cause for me, that's always like the big thing in indie 3D games is so few of them have characters. And it seems like Firewatch is the same way, at least from what I've seen so far. I mean, maybe there's, you know, some spoilery stuff from farther into the game where there is more character interaction, but it seems like, you know, it seems like the sort of solitude of it is a big part of it. To what degree was that a, you know, was that another one of these like game design decisions that happened to work out well, or did you guys sort of purposely approach it from, if we have to build dozens of characters, we're not going to have the time or budget to do it, so we just have to figure out a game that doesn't need that, or where did that come into things?
That was definitely, like, even pre-day one, I think, like, when Sean and Jake was thinking about starting their own team, that was immediately on their mind, is that, like, they came from, you know, doing Walking Dead, which has a lot of characters, so they know how, like, having believable characters, the actual visual representation of it is, like, super expensive. So they were saying, like, they were thinking, like, well, if the thing that really, if the thing that people really hang on to is actually just the dialogue, like how can we have a game where you have a lot of interesting dialogue without having to visually represent a character? That's actually the reason why we have the radio. Like the whole conceit of the game is actually based on the fact that we knew that the, you know, the resource of not being able to create really believable NPCs is why we have the, that whole mechanic. So,
but it's a mechanic that works well, right? Like, think of some of people's favorite games, and you have, like, BioShock, where actually communicating with someone on the radio is, like, a major, major narrative thing, right? And it allows you to do exactly what you're saying, is to add, like, okay, people are getting stuck here. You can be like, maybe if someone spends more than this amount of time in this trigger volume, that Delilah's like, you having a hard time? What are you doing over there? Head towards the blah, right? And you can do that way more easily than, like, you know, you probably for narrative reasons can't make her go find you there.
So. Right. Yeah, because like that was, I think when we were talking about the game, Last of Us has already come out, and you know, like Ellen's amazing, and it's, you know, it's great to definitely have a believable NPC sort of with you all the time. But we were like, come on, there's no way a team of 10 people can make something like Ellie. Like it's just not possible. So like you have to you know, you have to figure out like, well, let's distill what about what we can do is actually compelling that we can reach for. And so that's definitely, so like that's that I'm trying to say, I guess that it's definitely not an accident that we knew it was a constraint we had to work with. And I think we came up with a really good solution for it. So yeah, I like working with constraints because actually sometimes it forces you to make sort of more elegant design decisions. And
it often forces you to make new and interesting design decisions too. Like the general, you know, love for indie games and independently produced the stuff in general over recent years, I think is in part because it leads you to new solutions because you have to try new things and experiment and work around those constraints. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us. I think this has been a wonderful episode. How can people find more about what you are doing and what you are up to?
Sure. I guess people can follow me on Twitter at that Jane Ng. And that's usually where I hang out online, I guess. And if you want to follow along what Firewatch is doing, then go to firewatchgame.com and I guess sign up for our newsletter. And we hopefully will have news to share.
Yeah. Well, there's always little things coming out progressively over time. So especially now that you're starting, you have a real demo. So it's cool to see that stuff. I'll link those up in the show notes. Thanks for listening, everybody. We always want to know what you think about the show. So send us an email or a tweet. We're at Up Show on Twitter. And see you next time. Have you been playing any games recently? Are you too busy making art?
Sure. I've just basically been obsessed with Dragon Age Inquisition. That's been my life. So, yeah, that's mostly what I play or have been playing.
Are you in the first wave of obsession where you're still digging into all of it and getting through the game? Or are you in the second wave of obsession when you realize that after you beat it, that there are so many other things you can still do?
Oh, I'm definitely deep in the second wave.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because after I played Dragon Age Inquisition, that was actually the first Dragon Age game I played. So
interesting.
I played Inquisition, finished it, and then just couldn't get enough. And then I started playing Dragon Age Origins, and then Dragon Age 2, and then all the DLCs start coming out. So basically, I've been living in thetas nonstop for a while. But yeah, it gives me a lot of, I guess like sometimes it's nice to go sort of like on a little vacation every day to a place that I enjoy with like my RPG friends when like work is stressful.
Yeah, in a place where you basically like rule the planet and everyone loves you. What is the DLC for that like? I know I played the game immediately when it came out because I'm losing my patience more and more. I used to be very good at waiting till things went on sale and were patched, but I played it within like a week or so of it coming out. And but I haven't been following. What's the DLC for that?
So there's been three DLCs, and the most recent one that came out last week is, if you played to the end of Dragon Age Inquisition, there is sort of like a cliffhanger end. And this one is like sort of the real closure, the real ending to the game.
Okay.
So
there's more story. Yeah. Is that what they all are? Is like just kind of continuations of the story, or are they on the side?
This is actually the latest DLC is the only one that is a super story ending one. Whereas previous ones are more just like, hey, here's another map. You can do more stuff in it and it's cool. And this one is actually interesting because they decided to do a DLC that is only post-end game.
Yeah.
Which is really unusual.
They must have seen the stats that a certain number of people had beaten the game, because the stats are normally really low on any.
Yeah. But the people who finish the game are like hardcore need that DLC. So, So I enjoy it.
That's cool. Have you been playing anything, Nigel? We haven't actually talked. We work together and I still haven't.
We've been on a forced march of Mario Maker here the last 4 days. So we're recording on Monday, what, the 14th or something like that? 15th? Yeah. 14th, I think. And so Mario Maker came out 3 days ago as of recording, and I'm pretty sure that there has never been a gap of more than about an hour that one of the children is not playing Mario Maker. And so basically it's just like constantly, Daddy, can you come try out my level? Can you come try out my level? Can you come try out my level? So that's been my gaming the last few days.
And these are kids that were making Mario levels on paper for years.
Oh yeah, this is like the greatest thing that has ever happened in their life, the release of this game. It's truly unbelievable.
It's like a dream come true.
That's awesome. Do you feel like that they're start? I mean, it's only been 3 days, but do you feel like they're starting to get some of the cold, hard reality of level design yet? Or do you think that's going to take a while still?
It's tough to say. There's some elements in it that kind of, I think, force you down a path of interesting game designs if you're interested in making things hard. Like, if you just want to be like, all right, I'm just going to put, like, zillions of coins in this level and, you know, and just go nuts. Like, all right, well, that's not going to be fun and there's not much you can do about it. But all of the kids seem to want to make hard levels, and the tools that the game gives you, like, make it sort of easy to make something that's too hard and then tune it back to something that's just hard enough, because you have this, like, you know, you can always sort of pop in and out and replay any given section until you're satisfied with it. If you die, you always see, like, this back trace of, like, the last couple of seconds before you died. So you can be like, oh, I hit this thing and fell, or I just missed this jump. And if the thing was a block longer, and then if you want to upload your maps on the internet, you have to play through it once as part of the upload process. So you can't upload a map that you can't finish.
Oh, good. So it can. Yeah. So it always is possible to finish it at least once.
So, I mean, their levels that they're making certainly do not have what you would call, like, a coherent theme to them.
And now this is the water part, and now this is the spike part.
Yeah, but they're interesting. Like, they're definitely doing, I would say, better even than I expected them to, given their kind of interest in this stuff. Like, yeah, it's interesting. I've done like the tutorial thing and built like one level, and that's all that I could manage of actually building them. But I've played probably 20 or 30 levels since this started.
3 days ago.
3 days ago, yeah. Well, because there's three of them, so they're just doing it in shifts, right? It's always about like whose turn is it to get to play Mario Maker next.
That's great, though.
That's awesome. Yeah. I've been on a Destiny break, but the new one comes out like today or something, so I've been avoiding turning on my PS4 because I know I'm just gonna start. Actually, it might come out midnight, like in 2 hours from now. I don't know. I'm seeing so many tweets about it, but I know it's gonna suck me in, and everyone's saying like, oh, all the things that made you regret paying hundreds of hours of Destiny in the last version are better now, and I'm sure they're not.
Except that all of your progress from the last is now totally invalidated because there's a whole bunch of new items and things that you don't have.
But they're all shiny and cool. And
yeah, and watching people like have their love-hate relationship with Destiny has been so interesting to me.
It's one of the strongest versions of that I've seen in quite a while about a game that people, I mean, there's little like things like Farmville and stuff that people would get into, but as far as a AAA game that people play but kind of resent, I can't remember. Maybe, I mean, WoW, I guess, would count. It's the last time I can remember the number of people that I knew that would play
but
about
WoW
it.
Also kind of took a while to get to the whole love-hate part, I feel like. Maybe, I don't know.
No, I think you're right. I think people love-hated Destiny, like, after a week.
Like, pretty fast.
The first week, most people were actually fairly against it. Like, it got pretty lukewarm critical reviews, or even just negative. And then people were like, it's beautiful, but the storyline is dumb. But then when you get to the end game and the PvP, especially the PvP, then people start going, like, actually, this is a really well balanced multiplayer shooter, of course, because it's made by the people who made Halo. But then it also has the stuff that WoW had that made me keep want to make numbers get bigger.
Right. And keep clicking.
Click, 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 shoot, shoot, click, click. So we'll see how long I avoid that. But
because they don't even have, they just let you buy the DLCs, right? They don't have like a hat market or whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting they went for that model. And I now see that why they went for this. So they went this model where they sell the full game and then they periodically sell DLCs that you pretty much need to keep buying in order to keep playing, which is the sort of WoW model.
I see.
But WoW would release like an expansion every couple of years that would release like a lot of new content. Whereas Destiny is releasing like small expansions on a seasonal basis, almost like maybe every 5 months or something like that. And so what that's doing is that if you want to keep playing and you're playing against, like you're playing PvP, obviously everyone else is going to, their number is going to keep getting bigger, and you want your numbers also keeping bigger. And so as long as people are playing it still, then you can get a pretty fast treadmill of pulling money out of people that's not quite to the degree that WoW subscriptions at like whatever they were. What were they, $10 or $20 a month? It's not quite
like 15,
that pace.
I think.
Yeah. It's not quite that pace, but it's almost that fast that they're pulling money out of people. And then it continues to, in the same way that any other MMO does, it incentivizes them to keep people interested, to keep putting new content, to keep the game balanced and all that kind of stuff. So it seems to be working for them. I'm sure that eventually they're just going to degrade into a hat market and all sorts of stuff. But there's no small in-game purchases that you can make yet, which is...
Well, it also seems like with Taken King that... I mean, I don't know if this is just a pre-order bonus. It's a little unclear on like PSN or whether something that's going to remain the case. But at least if you pre-order the game, you get all of the previous content.
Right.
Oh. So if you go and buy Taken King like right now, like for like, I could actually totally take advantage of this because I got the original one and did not get either of the expansions because it didn't like grab me enough. And I have a physical disc copy of the original game rather than a digital copy because I just got like a used copy a couple months after it came out. And so I could now go and basically for the price of a like full price new game, get upgrade to a digital copy of like the original and get the two expansion packs and get the new game. So like then you're looking at it's in terms of speed of pulling money out of people, if you're willing to, you know, if you're sort of like, I'm interested in this, but not like obsessed with it, it could be no more of a money sink than any other yearly franchise. Like if you're into like Call of Duty or Assassin's Creed or any of the other big, like every year we put out a new $70 game. Like you could kind of play Destiny at that speed. You do even a little better, actually. If I, you know, with getting the used copy, if I got Taken King now, I'd really only be in for about $100 for 2 years worth of play. So,
and you wouldn't have to hear Peter Dinklage anymore. So,
yeah,
that's right. They paid to get all his lines re-recorded by somebody else, right?
Yeah, and they got like one of the most like accomplished voice actors in the gaming world.
Is Nolan North doing it?
Yeah,
of course.
How could he? I'm pretty sure he just is a default automatic for all games.
That's really funny.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly. Like, I know we know like one or two people who do like voice acting work. But when you get to the level of Nolan North, you would think that he's in enough games and games that have enough dialogue that like he just wouldn't have enough hours in the day. But maybe I'm just overestimating how much time it takes to record all that stuff.
I think when we record, it is 4 hour sessions, and you could record a lot of lines if you were good.
Yeah, so I guess there's not like there are very long games and there's a lot of dialogue, but that
like per actor, it may actually not be a lot of lines.
Yeah.
I think once you hit that level, also probably you've got the capability to record lines in a better way than most studios at home. Like at least one of the voice actors that I know actually has like home studio recording setup. So that if
like both of our VO people have, they just sit at home. So we just Skype in to voice direct them, and then they both record. So
and that makes some of that stuff like a lot simpler. If it's just like, oh, we need a really quick pickup session, then, you know, it's not drive to some recording studio and get everyone together. It's like, here's the dialogue. Yeah, meet on Skype at this time. Spend an hour recording those. And I'm sure, you know, you get paid more for that hour than, you know, a quarter of the amount you get paid for a 4-hour session, but you're also done really quickly.
1 hour is about the same as almost 4 hours. So we basically should just record 4 hours.
Yeah, I was actually talking to somebody at PAX who was a voice, where I think he's a game director. It works a lot with voice actors anyway. And he was saying that what he had heard about the, you know, controversy of Peter Dinklage's voice acting being so bad in Destiny was that it wasn't that he was like incapable of acting or even necessarily that he was directed poorly, although that was maybe some of the problem, but that a lot of it was just that he didn't have the schedule to be able to do pickups. So in his mind, and I guess in whoever signed the deal with him's mind, that he would be able to come in and record all the content and then go away.
But 4 hours, that's it.
You know? Or even like 40 hours or 100 hours. Yeah. But the game, any game is changing. Of course, you'll be like, oh man, this level is like, you know, way too hard. Let's pull it back. But then he still says like afterward, like, wow, that was the hardest fight we've seen yet. But it's just like three guys you fight or something, right? Like, just doesn't make any sense. So they start cutting stuff and then having to use other things to like patch in and also stuff that they're like, well, you know, we'll record this later, or they hadn't finalized it because they sort of maybe anticipated they would, I don't know. And then also apparently this thing, have you seen this thing about the lawsuit, the Bungie lawsuit that came out about...
About the composer, their composer.
Yeah, the composer.
Yeah. And so part of that lawsuit came out that they basically ditched like huge quantities of the story of the game like 4 months or 5 months before it was supposed to ship. And so I'm sure if it's like, oh, hey, we need Peter Dinklage for a whole bunch of voice acting time in this time frame. Yeah. That,
and he's like, sorry, filming Game of Thrones for the next 3 months.
Yeah, and all these other films and like...
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And doesn't Game of Thrones even film somewhere like weird, really far. Like not in North America?
Correct.
Yeah. I think, right?
Correct.
They film overseas somewhere.
It's like, I think, somewhere in Eastern Europe. For parts of it, and then some other place for parts of it and stuff.
Yeah.
All over, apparently.
Poor Dinklage.
Yeah. He'll just have to cry himself to sleep on his mattress stuffed with $100 bills.